Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Doppelganger Riley. Was that Scooby or?
Kind of, yeah.
And also with us is Spencer Vlad Williams.
Yoloski.
What was that? Did you have something stuck in your throat there for a second?
No, I am fine.
Well, as you can tell, we got a little bit of an issue of doppelganger-ness here because we are going to be talking about the movie Us, Jordan Peele's sophomore film. We'll be delving into that because it just released and we cannot wait. So, before we jump into that, Chad, why don't you give us them opening credits?
Just in case you were wondering, the Filmlosophers podcast is presented by our dear friends and occasional overlords at Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. In fact, you might say we're tethered to
Ooh.
Them. New episodes come above ground each Wednesday morning on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom.
Social media is the perfect place to become your own doppelganger and test out new versions of your personality, like becoming a movie critic, perhaps.
Hey!
You can find us exploring our shadow sides on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Last but not least, you'll find all the best versions of our movie reviews on filmlosophers.com. After all, we have over 155 on it. That's pretty good. I like that.
That was good. Yes, we got over 150 episodes on our website, so check them out, including last week's extra credit where we talked about the state of the MC Union and went about just kind of giving our thoughts on where we think the MCU is going, what our some of our predictions are for Endgame, and what we thought about in terms of other bigger threats.
Honestly, it's so hard to keep your attention on any of the movies that we're reviewing now that we're so close to Endgame.
It's true. We were literally just watching the trailer again that dropped today right before we started. So, getting our heads back into the game, we are going to go ahead and jump right into our review of Jordan Peele's Us. This has been one of the more anticipated films of 2019 because of the fact that Jordan Peele hit such great success with his previous film, Get Out, back in 2017. So with this film, not only did it have a great cast and it had an interesting storyline, it had this song in it, which is a really unique mix of the 1995 song I've Got Five on It. So I just honestly really want to hear this song because it's just a really interesting
mix. It's such a great like remix of like you take like a song that like a lot of people are familiar with in the 90s and then put this horror twist on it.
Yeah.
Like this was an amazing trailer.
So before we get too caught up in the music itself, Chad, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Sure. Haunted by an unexplainable and unresolved trauma from her past and compounded by a string of eerie coincidences, a mother feels her paranoia elevate to high alert as she grows increasingly certain that something bad is going to befall her family. A family's serenity suddenly turns to chaos when a group of doppelgangers begins to terrorize them.
Written and directed by Jordan Peele, the film stars Lupita Nyong'o, Winston Duke, Shahadi Wright Joseph, Evan Alex, Elizabeth Moss, and Tim Heidecker. With this being Jordan Peele's sophomore film, he gave the cast 10 horror films to watch so they could have a, quote, shared language when filming. Those films were as follows: 1991's Dead Again, 1980's The Shining, 2014's The Babadook, 2014's It Follows, 2003's A Tale of Two Sisters, 1963's The Birds, 1997's Funny Games, which is the original, 2008's Martyrs, 2008's Let the Right One In, and 1999's The Sixth Sense. Oddly enough, these are all great films, and now that I know that after the fact, which I found that in research, I can totally see a lot of that inspiration in this film. The film had its world premiere at South by Southwest on March 8, 2019, and was theatrically released to the United States on March 22nd. Which, mind you, when the film dropped, even before the film dropped, there was a ton of buzz coming out of South by Southwest from those who had seen it. They were raving about it. There was plenty of vague reviews because the embargo had not yet been released in terms of talking about full spoilers. So you got a slight gist of like what most people were experiencing when they went to go see the film. Numbers-wise, the budget for the film was $20 million estimated, and its opening weekend actually tripled that budget with $71 million domestically. And that's just domestically. As of right now, as of today, the domestic total is somewhere in the neighborhood of $77 million. So I'm wondering, I don't know if they've given a release date for the international release, but it's going to be interesting to see what...
Well, you know I don't do homework, so don't look at me.
It's going to be interesting to see how the rest of the world kind of responds to this film as well, seeing as how much... And I use this word respectively, but how much hype this film has had over the last month or so from people who have screened it and then people who saw it at South by Southwest for its premiere there and then for its theatrical release domestically. So it's going to be interesting to see like how other...
Well, I mean, it's one of those classic situations. It often happens in music where... Somebody has an amazing breakout record or album, and then everybody is waiting to see if they can replicate that level of success, likability, musicality, whatever it is, that X Factor appeal with their sophomore album.
Yeah.
And so everybody was blown away for the most part by Get Out. And so this is the sophomore album, essentially. It's the sophomore horror film, feature film, directorial, debut, so to speak, of Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
Who for so long was known for comedy.
Oh, completely.
And
I think we mentioned that back in our review for Get Out, that it's a surprise to see that like this type of mentality was hidden within his comedic, you know, endeavors. Like you think he's doing like a funny skit or whatever, and all the whole time he's been wanting to create a horror movie, or he's had scary stuff in his brain.
Well, and it's one of those things where you kind of they're almost two sides of the same coin. I mean, when you think about some of the Key and Peele sketches, many of them, it's subverting your expectations, right? Taking what you thought a situation was going to be and turning it on its head somehow, and they did it comedically there.
Yeah.
But then with each of these films, Get Out and Us, he applies that same type of thinking to a different genre and a much longer format, obviously.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I think even though I'm a huge fan of horror films within the dynamic of this table, I think out of the three of us, I think Spence might have been the one who was more excited to see this film than I was. Because of what reason, Spence?
Mostly Get Out. Plus, I've been following Jordan Peele ever since Mad TV. So, like, you know, he's been around a while for me.
He's been there for you?
Yeah, basically.
He comes by, you know, rocks you to sleep, sings you lullabies. Thanks, Jordan.
Okay, the movie's creepy enough. You don't need to do that, too.
No, but I remember... my friend Chuck telling us about this movie back in last December of like Jordan Peele
having a
second movie. And I was like, I need to see this movie the second it's available. And then the trailer came out and I was just blown away by that. So I was just ready to go. And I know this is going to sound kind of crazy.
It's coming from you, Spence. This should be about normal.
But... This is the movie I was really excited for this year, more so than Endgame.
Oh, we got to hold Chad back. And interestingly enough, you're right. We're getting a really bad head shake from Chad looking at Spencer.
Okoye is ashamed of you.
No, that's okay, true.
There you go.
Like, it's not nothing against Marvel or anything. It's just that.
Oh, she took it personally.
With Marvel, there's
she's
a certain...
She's going to beat you with a wig.
With Marvel, there's kind of a certain consistency. Like, you know, they're going to do... It'd be bizarre if...
Are you saying that Marvel is becoming formulaic?
No, I'm saying that, like, they're so consistent. It would be amazing if Endgame was a total flop. Like, I'd be shocked.
So,
but
how
does like,
that, how does I don't that, know that I'm, I can continue I'm, with this podcast I'm, episode, Spencer.
I'm bringing it back.
How
give me a
dare
second.
You?
Just the mere thought.
Did we get the shadow, Spencer?
I think we did.
I think we did.
Anyway.
Are you the tethered? Is that why you spoke in Russian before?
Right.
Anyway, the thing with us is that, you know, it was a question of, is Jordan Peele like a one-hit wonder? Could he just do Get Out, or could he come back and do something again?
Great point.
And that's what I was really excited to see.
I think that's actually a really great point. Before going forward and talking about that, I do want to make mention of something you had said earlier, which was that, yes, we did get information from a friend of ours that they were doing a quote-unquote special screening of a Jordan Peele film that could not be disclosed. The title was not disclosed. And that it was going to be back in early December. Mm-hmm. The problem for us here was that the stipulation on the invite was that you could not be a member of the press, or B, have pretty much an outlet to where you could talk about movies, or you had any ties to that, which unfortunately here, well, not unfortunately, fortunately/unfortunately here, we have a podcast, number one, and number two, we utilize the outlets that we are a part of to get into our press screenings. So needless to say, we were
disqualified.
We were disqualified instantly.
That's very sad about
now,
that.
Mind you, we could have snuck in.
I'm not going to risk a lawsuit.
But exactly. Exactly. There was some really scary language at the bottom of that invite, like, oh, you know, legal action will be taken if we found out, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, nope.
But so this is us stating for the record that we did not go to the press not allowed December screening.
We at Evian Weva, Chad Riley and Spencer Williams did not attend.
I've got receipts and text messages and everything. So
he's apparently been prepared for this conversation. But no, it's true, though. I was thinking about that as well. One of the unique things that we've always kind of meddled around with in terms of thought process was that can a horror director, or at least a suspense thriller director, create that same lightning in a bottle effect the second time around? Is it possible for them to actually keep the momentum going with their sophomore film? The biggest kind of example that everybody's pulled from in the last decade and a half was, or actually almost two decades, was M. Night Shyamalan, who really struck gold with his first debut film, The Sixth Sense, which Jordan Peele mentions in the list of films that he gave to his cast to watch. The Sixth Sense came out with immense success. It was very unique. It had a very unique storyline. The problem was that its follow-up film, which was, I believe, Signs?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Signs was not as successful as Sixth Sense. And it kind of started spiraling downhill.
Well, because it toyed with you. It didn't really do what you wanted it to do, but not in a subverting expectations kind of way. It was sort of like, oh, so we don't get to see the bad guys very much?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And the bad guys wanted to invade a planet that is 75%.
This is a total sidebar, but I was looking in the annals of the Filmlosophers podcast, and I found that our review of Get Out was less than 95, 60 episodes ago. And I do believe, wasn't this the first one that you did with us, Spencer?
No, the first one I did was Mother.
Oh, that's right. We had to make it up to you with Get Out. Because Mother was so disturbing.
It was.
Mother! I forgot.
But I think it is something to note, like, especially with Jordan Peele. We've already stated that Jordan Peele has his origins in comedy. With his start, I don't even know what he did prior to Mad TV, but I know he had a stint on Mad TV along with his soon-to-be co-star, Keegan-Michael Key.
Yep.
And then they eventually graduated to having their own show called Key & Peele for several seasons, which was widely successful because it was unique and it was funny and it was its own kind of humor. And then eventually they did a film together. They actually have a an appearance in the new Toy Story film.
Mm-hmm.
So their comedic escapades as a duo is still recognized. But after the last season of Key and Peele, that's when you heard that Jordan Peele was going to try his hand at suspense thriller, even borderline horror. And after the release of Get Out, it just became all over the world. Everybody was talking about, oh, well, now he can do horror. Let's see what else he can do. And then it wasn't until mid-2018 when he announced they were going to be doing, or he was going to be doing a second horror film, which was then publicized back in December, like we said, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, the whole Twilight Zone thing, which I'm super excited for. But it's true. Like, wondering whether or not he was going to hit it on the mark, not just out of the park, but actually hit the mark with what he was doing for his horror, you know, ability. This film was going to be pretty much detrimental to how people were going to perceive his capability of doing that moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, if he didn't do a good job, then all that luster kind of fades a little bit, which is sort of, I mean, that's the world we live in, and it's really upsetting. I mean, for talented creatives, I would say even somebody like an M. Night Shyamalan, who probably has had just as many misses as he has had hits.
Yeah.
Possibly more misses than hits, but some of the hits are really, really good.
Yeah.
And so it's rough because there's a lot of expectation,
mm-hmm.
Not only from the general audiences, but on the studio side with regard to how much money they're going to give you and what they want and how quickly they want it and all of it. So there's bound to be a lot of pressure, and it easily could fall apart. Especially when you've got something like this where every film project, whether it's short film, feature length, made for TV movie, TV series, whatever, they're all a group effort. You need a team to accomplish it, both in terms of the creative team and usually in terms of the investing as well. The studio partners, you know, all the names that you see at the beginning of the credits.
Yeah.
All the companies that are involved with every movie. And so, you know, everything's a group effort, so to speak. However, every once in a while, you get this singular voice, this singular creative presence. You know, you think of like a Tim Burton or a Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and they kind of get, they settle into a groove, and people generally like them enough to keep them in business.
Yeah.
And they become almost like an auteur within a mainstream, you know, medium like film. And Jordan Peele with Get Out really like totally crossed over into that spectrum, but just completely. With one movie.
Yeah.
So you've got to see like, okay, is that a one-hit wonder, or is it like a almost like a franchise of its own, right?
Yeah.
The Jordan Peele tone. You know, like sort of not unlike an Alfred Hitchcock
mm-hmm.
within this genre, with the suspense and the horror and the like making you tense up, but not pandering to the masses with just a bunch of gore.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
which is what a lot of horror films do. Saw franchise, mm-hmm. Final Destination, all that mess, where it's just like, okay, it becomes almost comical. Not that it's funny, but I mean, it's just ridiculous. The goriness. But the true craftsmanship, what Hitchcock was known for, was the suspense angle.
Yeah.
Was like really making you feel tense, all your muscles are tight, and it makes you think either during or after or both.
Yeah.
You know, a viewing experience. Get Out certainly did that, and I think a lot of people were wondering, is this going to do it too? Is the movie Us going to accomplish that same kind of a tone and visceral kind of feel?
And I think even on top of the suspense factor, I think also speaking on like social commentary of the world today and what the first film, what Get Out accomplished in terms of creating that impact and the message it conveyed within his first film, mind you. Seriously, we were hearing after the fact, like even months, how there were college professors who were doing whole analysis of the film itself, and there were people who were doing papers and people that were doing like in-depth, you know, researches into the whole gist of what every piece of message Jordan Peele was trying to say with Get Out. I mean, it became a worldwide phenomenon to dig deeper into because it had so many different layers to it. And I think that was also that, aside from the suspense and so forth, I think that was also another expectation for fans coming into the film hoping to see that same social commentary, if not on the exact same thing that Get Out spoke about, on something nevertheless at that level. Because I think that was even something we talked about here on the show when we were discussing that review. Lesson 95. When we were discussing it then, where I think we had a few thoughts and ideas on what the whole message was coming about and how we perceived it and so forth. So, and even here, I mean, mind you, we receive certain messages and we can see certain parts of that, you know, as it was conveyed to us. And that's what makes certain films unique, because you have more than just a film. You have more than just a story, but you have the heart behind it. You have the idea. And Jordan Peele conveyed that pretty easily with Get Out. So with coming back around to us, I kind of want to go around the table and see what were some of our expectations in terms of going into the film. And I kind of want to start with Chad first, because I want to end with Spencer and kind of get his idea, since he was the one who had the most anticipation for it. So, Chad?
Well, we all know that I'm not a fan of the genre.
I know. We did have
no
to drag you in
there.
Kicking and
yeah.
screaming.
I'm also now not a super fan of scissors. But so I... One of the things that Get Out did that I was impressed with was it didn't really fit only in the horror genre. I mean, we really are part of our conversation around that review was, what genre is it fair to stick it only in one genre?
Yeah,
because it's very thought provoking. Again, very much like a Hitchcock movie, where you're really thinking. It's cerebral, in addition to like the visceral, like, oh, I'm uncomfortable. I don't want to see this. Are you going to show me something I don't want to see? Okay, no, you didn't go as far as you could have.
Yeah.
And I'm thankful for that, because it keeps it at just like a thought-provoking level and not like I'm totally grossed out and the only thing I'm going to remember stepping out of the theater is how yucky all that blood was or whatever. You know, like instead you come out thinking, wow, there was something really compelling about the quote-unquote argument that this movie is making.
Yeah.
The commentary that the movie is inviting us to continue having while we walk out of the theater and for weeks thereafter. Sort of what you were talking about with the whole, like, you know, college lectures and papers and things. Like, it really gets your mind spinning. Your gears are turning.
Yeah.
And you don't want to stop, almost like, you know, like a fidget bot or a fidget spinner or whatever. Like
fidget cubes.
It's like
all that.
You don't want to stop interacting with it. You want to keep going for a while.
Yeah. Is that why there's a fidget cube in the couch over there?
Maybe.
Okay.
So what I was hoping for, because I'm not a fan of the genre, I was hoping for going into this film is that us would do something similar but different.
Yeah.
Where it wouldn't be only creepy, gross, and disturbing, but would give me something to keep mentally fidgeting with afterward. That's what I wanted going in.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the biggest expectations I had was just to hope, kind of like what Spencer had mentioned earlier, was to hopefully see a film that was reminiscent of the same caliber we saw with Get Out. Not in terms of like, oh, it's going to sweep the nation with another, you know, incredible idea of like what the world is around us and so forth, and people are going to go nuts or whatever. I mean, mind you, it could happen that way, but that's not what I was wanting to see. I just wanted to see a well-executed story that not only just conveys, you know, raw emotion and the amount of suspense that you expected from Get Out, but also leaves you with an idea of like, this taught me something and I can grow from that. I mean, which doesn't always happen in every film you see. You see it in very unique films. Maybe like we mentioned in a couple episodes back where we talked about favorites from 2018, one of them being Blindspotting. And Blindspotting, it wasn't a horror film, but you learned something from it. It was really great. It's very rare where you find an opportunity to learn something from a suspenseful slash horror film. So knowing that he did that with the first one, I was really hoping to see that I was going to get just as much out of this one as I did from Get Out. So, what about you, Spence? Lay it on us.
Okay.
Oi.
So after, you know...
He's got an itemized list.
No, I'm going to make this short.
The rest of the show is yours.
There we go.
So after the first trailer drop and, like, you just see these duplicates in red jumpsuits just darting all over the place, I was like, okay, this seems like a pretty good premise if he just avoids certain, like, cliches of, like, the, oh, we're dealing with duplicate type situations. So I was just really hoping that he would avoid, you know, just being super cliched, and also, like, you know, like you guys were saying, we're keeping, like, me thinking after I left the theater, because mm-hmm. that's actually probably one of the things I liked about Get Out the most, is that, you know, there was, like, kind of, like, multiple stories going on with that. Mm-hmm. There's the actual story, and then there's, like, well, if you think about it this way, it's this, and if you think about it this way, it's this.
Yeah.
And, you know, Us does kind of have that. So, you know, I was looking forward to learning, like, what he was doing and if he could keep it up.
Yeah. Well, diving into the review, before we get into that, we do want to let you know that we are going to have a little bit of a spoilery conversation at the tail end of our talk, at the tail end of our review. So be warned, we're not going to do spoilers yet, but we will let you know when we hit the spoilers. So you have been warned.
I mean, if you haven't seen the movie, there are going to be, like, low-level spoilers throughout, but then at the end, there are some larger spoils that you might want to
steer away from.
Not here.
Mm-hmm. So we will let you know.
So you'll
when that
hear some
comes.
Story details that you wouldn't know just from watching the trailers.
Yeah.
But it's not, like, you know, egregious until the end.
So jumping in, obviously you got Lupita Nyong'o, who plays the mother. You have Winston Duke, who plays the father. Shahadi Wright Joseph and Evan Alex, they play the children. They're going to, well, okay, so the film kind of starts back in 1986.
I was
going to
say, you're skipping Santa Cruz.
I was getting there.
How can you skip Santa Cruz?
You get this, at the beginning, you get this glimpse of this little girl who's watching TV, and there's an advertisement for, like, this Hands Across America thing back in 1986, and there's an advertisement for, you know, Santa Cruz Boardwalk, and so she decides she wants to go there for her birthday, so her parents take her. Her parents are kind of bickering back and forth. The dad, who's been drinking, is kind of, like, very lackadaisical, kind of just like, yeah, let's do this, let's do that. And the mom's kind of being more rigid. She's like, you need to watch her. You need to keep an eye. All in all, she ends up wandering off while her dad's playing whack-a-mole and ends up wandering into this beachside a little walkthrough.
That's like one of those House of Mirrors type things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things. And she ends up going in. And just like in the trailer, she ends up walking right into a dark area where she runs into her doppelganger. And she freaks out, and the scene ends there. And that's when it fast forwards to present day. And that's where we have the introduction of the family that I just mentioned, which I don't remember their names offhand, but we'll get that later. As they are driving to what looks to be the Santa Cruz area, and they're going there for, I guess, their summer home or just a visit. It's never really stated as to how long they're going to stay. They just show up and it's like Airbnb. I don't know.
Well, it's like, it's her childhood home.
That's right. It's her childhood home.
I was going to say, they've been there before.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And so they're there, and you find out that Lupita Nyong'o was that little girl who had gone through a traumatic experience. She's, you know, they don't really explain, like, how it happened, but they show her, like, going into therapy and trying to learn how to talk after the traumatic experience. She learns how to pick up dancing so that she can express herself and be able to, you know, talk again. And so Lupita Nyong'o is pretty on edge being back in Santa Cruz. She doesn't like being back in Santa Cruz, and she makes it very aware to everybody. And Winston Duke, being the dad, seems a little obtuse to all the signals that she's giving.
It's because he's throwing out dad jokes for days.
He really is. I was going to say, I think I told Chad this. Winston Duke looked like he was made to be a dad for, like, his entire life. Like, mm-hmm. everything he said, I'm like, you must be a dad off screen. Because
unless he's M'Baku. I mean,
true.
Then he's made to be a warrior.
That is also true. The children, they're unique in themselves. You have a preteen or a teenager. Don't really know how old she is, but she's coming into junior high, I believe, or high school. And, you have the youngest son, who's a boy, who's a little bit socially awkward. But nobody really mentions it much within the family, except for, the sister, who kind of makes fun of him sometimes, you know, how siblings are. And so they're pretty much there for the time being. They end up deciding to go to the Santa Cruz beach, where it kind of kicks off a little bit of the craziness, and that's where things kind of begin to spiral out of control. So kind of going back to the family dynamic, I really have to give props to where props are due, and Lupita Nyong'o is one of those performers who, ever since her debut in 20 Years a Slave,
12 Years a Slave.
12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
12 years. She's just been like appearing in great films one after another. One of them being, of course, obviously Black Panther. And in this film, we get to see a much broader range of her ability to perform. And I really think she's one of the standout performers in this film. Like, mm-hmm. by far.
Well, it's her movie.
Oh, no doubt.
I mean, she is the main character of the movie.
Yeah. But you're used to seeing... Not that it's been one note, like, because we've seen her play a mother type in
Queen of Katwe.
That's right, and she does really great in that film, which we did a review on that. We'll find the lesson in a little bit, but that was one of those standout films where she plays a really, really heartfelt mom, and in this one she plays a mom, but she also plays a survivor as well, like someone who survival instincts kick in to protect her family. And it's really great to see how much more Lupita Nyong'o can do as a performer, as opposed to just playing the norms, you know? Like, this is one of those instances where she really shines.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's playing two characters, so
yeah.
That's mm-hmm. always fun when you, for any performer, to do two characters at all. I mean, if you're playing twins or whatever, but it's something like this, I mean, you're literally playing both sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing the quote-unquote light and the quote-unquote dark version of that person. Because the whole setup of the film basically is like these doppelgangers in the red jumpsuits are not like figments of their imagination.
No.
Or anything. Like they are physical human beings that are tethered, as they say. They don't really explain exactly how, but tethered experientially, mentally, emotionally, whatever. They're tethered to the surface world version. So these are people, creatures, that don't exist above ground. They exist below ground.
Yeah.
And their life path mirrors the people on the surface world to some extent, but then they have these dark and twisted components that
yeah.
are not exactly the same. And so you've got reflections of yourself, so to speak, but then this huge divergence at the same time.
Yeah.
Because things that are, you know, like, for example, Winston Duke, his surface world character, his normal human character, dad jokes for days, he's talking all the time, mm-hmm. he's, you know, upbeat and jolly and whatever, and his shadow self can't really form words at all. Most of them can't.
Yeah.
And he's cruel,
yeah.
abusive, you know, not good to be around. Like he's the opposite. And so it's for all of them, really, the family and then some of the other secondary cast members. It's interesting because they get to play two versions of the same character.
Yeah.
With certain parameters, obviously, because you have to keep some mystery around the reality of the tethered's life experience until you're ready to reveal it as the show goes on.
Yeah.
So you don't get... The fact that they can't speak is really smart because mm-hmm. you don't have independent characters telling you. You have one character who's able to speak using English words, really, and that is the other version of Lupita Nyong'o's character.
Which, even then, she struggles with to get words out. It's almost like she's forcing it out of her throat to communicate. What about you, Spence? Any standout characters for you?
No, it's just Lupita Nyong'o. She like did an amazing job just being like these two polar opposite characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really fun to watch her attack herself. because like that was just wild. Like when they first meet up, like how one of them is just all threatening and the other one is scared.
Yeah.
What the heck is going to happen?
Yeah. Because it's really interesting how the doppelgangers move and how they kind of operate. It's almost like their movements are kind of like lagged a bit. Like it's very unique the way they walk or the way they turn or the way they, because every single movement that they make is obviously based on their others, the way they move, because the people who are on the surface, their moves tend to dictate how the doppelgangers move. So they're moving against what I guess natural programming would dictate them to do. So it's really interesting. Like Lupita Nyong'o's character, her doppelganger, is very, very graceful, if that's the best way to put it. Like the way she moves, it's almost like every time she walks or she goes somewhere, it's with very upright posture. It's with very much grace and care as she like pirouettes around a corner here, or she stops and then sidesteps and then moves this way. But as a whole as well, like a lot of them, they're very, it's creepy. Essentially it is, uh-huh, because it's very creepy the way they move. And because a lot of it is them forcing themselves to not do the exact same thing as their doppelganger. And another unique thing about the doppelgangers is that you are not just seeing the doppelgangers of this family. What is actually happening is there are doppelgangers from around the world, I would assume, or at least to their knowledge around the Santa Cruz area, that are appearing and trying to destroy their other. Because you find the friends of the family, which are played by Elizabeth Moss and Tim Heidecker, the family friends who live in a house down the street from them, they get attacked, as well as their kids, by their doppelgangers. And it's really interesting to see how they're, at this point in the film as you're watching, how they're choosing to continue to reveal the fact that there are other doppelgangers other than this family. Because you watch the trailers and you instantly assume, okay, it's this one family's doppelgangers who are attacking everybody. And that would make kind of sense, because it's like, okay, there's not really any mention during the trailers that there's more than just those doppelgangers. But then you see how this family's doppelgangers work, and the way they portray like the opposite mentalities of the main characters, like of them, their surface selves, it's really trippy. Like the way Jordan Peele really put the effort into creating these characters, it's almost kind of eerie. Like this guy took some kind of psychological class or something. I don't know.
He probably did. Yeah, when those others started popping up, I was like, oh no, this is going to go very bad very quickly. Because,
yeah,
like, I was just, the initial assumption was just that for some reason the four that you meet were,
yeah,
just supernaturally fast for some outrageous reason.
Yeah.
And that's what I was expecting. I was not expecting, like, other people to just pop into this movie, because that was a lot.
Yeah, it's really trippy. And you're right, like, some of the ones that you see really moving fast, they're either because their doppelganger was a track star, or their surface person is like really strong or something. It's interesting how, like I said, they portray these doppelgangers, because to do that kind of a character study on individual people that you create, you have to look at both, kind of like what Chad's mentioned before, you have to look on both the good side of that character and the most opposite side, the most evil way of that person, and kind of create those two as unique characters all on their own.
Yeah, typically, it's, I guess, terminology, you'd call it the foil, right?
Okay.
You've got, let's say, the good character, and then the foil to the good character is the bad character, who, in all the ways that the good character is good,
uh-huh,
the bad character is bad. And usually those are two different characters, and they can be different genders, different ages, different, like, life experience. It doesn't matter. That's what you get, your superhero, supervillain, or, you know, whatever. Whatever,
yeah,
the case may be, you emphasize in the storytelling aspect. It's less of a, it's less of a like deep psychological profile of a fully formed human being, although the actor certainly, the actors are meant to bring that to the role,
mm-hmm.
with the subtext and all of that. But it's really meant to be those broad brush strokes of sort of whatever that core dichotomy is that you're exploring in the story. So yeah. story element wise, you're looking at the really good something and the really bad opposite something, and your characters are kind of exploring or fighting in between those two extremes.
Yeah.
So it establishes a continuum and you explore both ends. What they do here is they take that idea and multiply it times the number of characters in the movie to a certain extent. You still, the primary dichotomy is between the two versions of Lupita Nyong'o's character.
Yeah.
Or characters, I guess. They're two different women, same age, like mirror-ish experiences. So they are their own foil. So in all the ways that one is good, the other is bad, or, you know, whatever, if you don't want to be that subjective, you know, that the other has the opposite experience. But then there are these remarkable ways where they are similar because they're tethered. They're meant to exhibit some of the same characteristics. It's true of all of them where, you know, the daughter is, she runs track and field.
Yeah.
In like surface world version. And then the tethered world version, the shadow world version, is even faster, but she's also a runner.
Yeah.
The little boy, he has the whole thing where he keeps putting on his Chewbacca mask up and down and whatever, and he's trying to make a magic trick toy throw sparks, and
yeah.
it's not working. And you learn that the shadow version of him, the tethered version, wears a mask all the time.
Yeah.
And when he doesn't have the mask on, you learn why. But then he also has this fascination with fire.
Mm-hmm.
He's a pyromaniac.
Yeah.
And so they are to some extent similar, and to in other regards, they're their own polar opposites. It's really
yeah.
fascinating to see it played out. Again, usually you see it with two different characters,
mm-hmm.
and they're fighting for dominance in
yeah.
some way, psychologically, physically, whatever. This movie, you've got multiple characters, multiple areas where there's one spot and two people trying to occupy it.
Yeah.
And only one of them is going to get to occupy it in the end.
Yeah. And I think that's such an interesting dynamic in terms of like storytelling, especially from Jordan Peele. We mentioned that one of the things we really wanted to make sure and see was the consistency of great storytelling from what he did with Get Out and into this film. And I think that's a really unique perspective because, yes, there are certain films that this movie pulls like the ideas from. Like, if anybody's seen the 1980s film The Chuds, which I've seen it several times. It's Chuds are cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers.
Oh, brother.
Is that why he had that VHS tape at the beginning of this movie?
I actually got excited. I'm like, the Chuds. Yes, I like that movie. Right next to the Goonies. But, I mean, and even with the Goonies, I mean, there's an emphasis on underground, like beneath the surface. But Chuds is one of those movies where it's just like there's these crazy, creepy underground dwellers that are going to be, you know, taking people down and, you know, they have to fight them off and whatnot. This perspective is not so black and white. Because you have somebody who is human and they are, I mean, they make emphasis, they make a point to state the emphasis of they are human people. They are people. They're not just monsters. They're not creatures. They're not some figment of somebody's imagination. They are people and they want to be treated as such. And then the whole Highlander aspect of like there can only be one, you know, kind of comes into play where they don't want to be tethered to their doppelgangers. But that, like Chad was saying, that tethering, you see multiple times throughout the film where the main character, which we focus on is Lupita Nyong'o, you see where both of them come so close in terms of almost mimicking the exact same sentiments at times because of how, although vastly different, there are certain parts of their lives that are very important to them. One of them being the son, Jason.
Well, and I mean, they're... They are unique. among all the tethered individuals, if that's all of us, or, you know, whatever, you don't really get a sense of how widespread this reveal is around the world. But they are unique in terms of the two parts of the same person, or two people of, that sort of share a spiritual essence or whatever. It's not really ever defined for you, which is one of the things that's a little maddening about it. But they are unique still among that because, again, she's the only one who speaks, you know, the only one of the tethered who speaks at all in the movie. Like, and it's, you're led to believe that she's the only one who would speak.
Yeah.
Among all of them. And so the nature of that dynamic and the collision of those two individuals is the core of the movie, because among everyone, their pairing is unique.
Yeah. And mind you, this delves into, as we get closer to that spoilery area we were talking about, to note before that, like, the film does culminate into this huge climactic moment where both of Lupita Nyong'o's characters come to a point where they have to fight each other, essentially, so that this whole thing for the threat against her family can end. And even in that, like, last dynamic of their speech, the way the red mom is, you know, talking to the regular mom, the surface dweller mom, and telling her, like, this is how my life has been, this is what I've faced, this is what's been going on, and, you know, that's why we're so unique, and that's why we're, you know, doing the whole, I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Guy Pearce version of The Time Machine, but there's a great ending. Like, the movie was kind of blah, but the way the ending works is, like, Jeremy Irons is, like, the ultimate Morlock, and he has this great conversation with Guy Pearce in terms of, like, you know, this is why the world is the way it is, and this is why, you know, whatever you do, it's always going to end up in failure. And it's a great conversation. Mind you, Jeremy Irons looked horrible in that movie, but nevertheless, the dynamic of that conversation is similar to how I saw in this one, where these two people both want the same thing. They both want to exist in peace, but one of them has to go, and you have this unique, elegant fight. Because I say elegant, I mentioned earlier how Lupita Nyong'o's character is, the red version, is very graceful, and she's it's very dance-like, the way she runs away and the way she's moving. It's a very unique dynamic to the way how the film ends and how that whole scene ends, which we'll dive into that spoiler area right now. So, spoiler warning for anybody who's listening, this is your spoiler warning. So essentially, the surface dweller Lupita Nyong'o ends up killing the red mom, saving her son, and getting out of there, and they end up in this ambulance to leave town to get out of the craziness and the madness. But then, go ahead, Spence, because you're itching to... I see you're already pawing at your chin. Why don't you tell us how this ends?
Okay, so while she's driving the ambulance away from all the danger, like, you suddenly get a flashback of her back in that mirror house.
Back in 1986.
Yeah, back in 1986. And then, like, her doppelganger strangles her and takes her down to the underworld and locks her to a bed. And the doppelganger goes up to the surface. So the whole time you've actually been cheering for the doppelganger to actually defeat the original copy of Adelaide.
So the original surface-dwelling Adelaide was, in fact, the doppelganger who came to the surface at the beginning of the film, which is the reason why she could talk to some extent, and the Adelaide that was found and sent to therapy and so forth, that was why she had difficulty speaking, because she had never spoke before.
Right.
And the way that ends, it ends in, like, Lupita Nyong'o, after the flashback, Lupita Nyong'o looks down at her son, Jason, whom she had just rescued from that horrible place, looks up at her very puzzled, and she looks at him and gives, like, a slight, sly smile. I guess, trying to be reassuring, but it comes off as very creepy, and the little boy's just looking at her like, what? And they drive off into a sunset of smoke and chaos and destruction. And I think that is where the issues begin for us.
Yeah, that as well as one us. Thing just blows up so many ridiculous questions.
Because I know we immediately talked about the movie right after we stepped out, briefly, not into any depth, but there was something that Spence had said about the way that ending made you feel.
It was kind of a letdown because I was expecting that from just a basic, like, you know, of, like, at some point in a doppelganger movie, you're going to switch people around because that's what everyone does. And so I guess I was kind of hoping he wouldn't do that because I was expecting that from the get-go. But I don't know. Like, there's like a lot of the little...
It's okay, Spence. This is a safe area. You can speak.
The problem I really have is that there's a lot of the little details that suddenly become big, well, actually problems. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, okay, so you've put the original child down underground. Someone, for some reason, eventually lets her out. Why doesn't she just leave? Because, like, even if she didn't see where she came down from, the later on, near the end of the movie, like, the person pretending to be Adelaide walks down there fairly easily with no security mechanisms. There's no real reason why a child couldn't have just walked out.
Well, I think to that, I think... Oh, you're talking about the first time around. That's a great point. I was going to say something. Go ahead, Jed.
Well, I think it's one of those... I mean, that's where you get your tie into the Sixth Sense, kind of, where something has been true the whole time that you may or may not have seen. Because obviously, even in the Sixth Sense, people figured it out before.
Yeah.
Before the character figured it out for himself. So,
like, he got shot. What happened to that bullet?
I mean, as long as you're there, you're actively paying attention, you're going to figure it out early. I mean, there are some things fairly early on with Surface World Mom. But then, especially when you get into some of the fighting, she gets looks on her face or she does certain things that are like, oh, this mom is kind of like them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More than like the other normal service people. And then when her son is abducted and taken down into the below world, whatever they call it, she knows exactly where to go.
Yeah.
Like, she does not need directions. And it's not like the mom instinct. It's just like she goes kind of cautiously but fairly rapidly because it's like she knows what she's doing. And then in the scene when they finally battle it out.
Yeah.
And one of them ends up winning, securing dominance. Like, the way that she does it and her face and her posture and everything, it's like, oh, see? That's exactly. She's the other one of her, not the her, the other her. She's the other. They switched way back when. So by the time then, I can see what you're saying. Because by the time, you know, a couple of minutes later in the kind of the end little scene, you already know what's going to be revealed. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of showing you that you were right.
Yeah.
And wondering, like, oh, what does that mean? Because honestly, by the end of the movie, there are a whole lot of tethereds.
Yeah.
And as far as we're led to believe, very few, not like a surface world people left.
Yeah.
They've kind of all been taken out by their doppelgangers.
By their doppelgangers.
So what does it mean to be, quote unquote, a normal family in a world of pseudo zombies?
True.
But then, as the audience, you know that even the normal family includes one who's like one of the zombie type people.
Yeah.
And she knows it for herself now too.
Right. And I think that leads to kind of along the same lines of what, I mean, although The Sixth Sense had that unique ending where, yes, there were people who expected it, but the way the reveal happened, it was like, oh, that's actually really unique. That's really cool, the way they reveal it. I think for this film, I don't think the focus was to kind of say, oh, and by the way, here's something you didn't know. I think it was more as like kind of like what Chad had mentioned earlier, kind of like an homage, if you will, kind of honoring the films that we had stated a little bit ago that Jordan Peele had given to the cast to rewatch for the sake of like finding that common language, that shared language for the film. I think this was an opportunity to honor that, which we mentioned earlier was one of those unique films by M. Night Shyamalan that really kind of changed the landscape of horror suspense in the early 2000s, late 90s. So I don't think this was so much of a focus of like, oh, and so we're throwing this out there that you never expected, wink, wink. And it's more of like, and we're going to cap it off with this because this is just one of those things that kind of follow suit. And it's a fun little way to end the film.
It's kind of like seeing whether or not the top falls at the end of Inception.
Yes.
Right? Like Nolan didn't show you. It's
no.
Like, oh, is it wobbling? Is it going to, oh, the movie ended. I don't know. I'm freaking out. And here, at least he does us the service of like, hey, that thing that you suspected for probably most of the movie and definitely by the end of it, I'll just go ahead and confirm it for you.
Spence is struggling here.
It doesn't mean that you know what's going to happen to that family afterward. You can still be very conflicted about it.
No, this is what I've been stuck on for like the last week. Is what is like the overall messaging of this movie? Because like it's not just about doppelganger families are here. It's like, what else is this movie trying to say? And I was having a hard time really like trying to piece it together. So I started talking to other people to help me out because like this one was really like giving me some trouble. And I'm thinking the reason that maybe he did the flip-flop in the first place is because I think he's trying to show that overall this is a story about two groups of people. You've got one people who live in happy sunshine surface land, and then you've got this other group of people who just live down in the darkness eating rabbits for some reason.
Rabbit's not bad, especially when it's cooked.
Yeah, but it didn't look cooked at all. I think part of what he's trying to allude to is the fact that like sometimes you are born in a place of privilege and it's just the fact that you're born there that you have that privilege. If your circumstances were slightly different, you'd be a just slightly different person. And I think that's kind of like what the flip-flop is about.
Yeah.
But like, I'm still kind of struggling with it.
Yeah, and that's an interesting perspective. Like, I think kind of going back to that, the way that ending is, I mean, there are multiple ways you could kind of explain as to what that flashback means. I mean, we have no idea as to the ramifications of removing one of those individuals from the tether. I mean, there could possibly be an opportunity where it's explained as, well, then the memories of the tether go to the one that's still there, so the singular person who's no longer tethered has the memories of both of them. Or, and maybe that's how they're going to go about existing because they have memories that, you know, they can, like, I don't remember at all where Winston Duke's other knew how to ride a boat or do whatever. Not that he killed him yet.
Well, I assume it's because he was mirroring the original, so he just mirrored it again. See, the whole tethering process starts to get really muddy when, like, you go off into this weird tangent because then, like, before, in 1986, it looks like all of the duplicates are, like, just mirroring by default.
Yeah.
And, like, that's just what they do. But somehow, over time, I'm guessing because Adelaide went down there and was stuck there, they learned how to not mirror and only mirror on demand or something, which also gets really weird because you've got the original Adelaide down in the underground, but then she's mirroring her tether for some reason? Why did that happen? Because there was, like, a dance recital where the duplicate is dancing, but then the real Adelaide is dancing in the underground for some reason.
Yeah, like, the thing that was the weakest to me was like the whole conceit of the tethered. Because
yes.
What really broke it for me was when they started going and showing you the flashbacks to like 1986 with the tethereds and their quote unquote real version up above doing similar activities like talking to each other or, you know, playing
rock,
carnival games or whatever. And I'm like, the first thing that I had a problem with was, wait a minute, this whole environment underground seems to be fairly restrictive and like structured.
Yeah.
How did they all get in the same place? They don't have cars. Like, people above ground have cars or airplanes or boats. Like, how would they all be in the same place? They just happen to all be there. Like, it's once you start looking into the mechanics of the conceit, it totally falls apart.
Fast. Yeah.
Because there's it defies the suspension of disbelief. Like, as long as you're in the moment, like the feel of the movie, the emotion and the tension of the movie, you're fine.
Yeah.
But the second that you try to like super engage the logical part of your brain, it really loses traction.
True.
In ways that Get Out never had to run that risk.
Right. Yeah. And mind you, I think just like going back to like the 1980s movie, the Chuds, like a lot of those types of
it's just a funny word.
Chuds?
Yeah.
Cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers?
Okay.
I mean, hey, you know. No, but I think just like those ones, how there's no rhyme or reason for a lot of that happening. And just for the sake of going back to the mindset of like giving homage to the films that gave inspiration to this, I think this is one of those perspectives where I don't think it's intended to dwell too much on it. Yeah. But then the caveat to that is it's a Jordan Peele movie. And much like Get Out, where, like we mentioned, was vastly researched and analyzed and scrutinized to the mere like millisecond of each, you know, frame of the film, to expect fans to not dwell on it too much is kind of, you know, robbing your audience of what they came in to expect for the film.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see both arguments on either side of like, well, this is just to give homage to whatever this film inspired it, or this is to, you know, reference back to that, or, you know, 1997's Funny Games, or the, you know, The Shining, or whatever. It's easy to pick a side for this particular argument, but it's hard to make one stick.
Well, I think part of the problem is he started to try to explain things in universe, and that's where things start to get muddy, because like it starts off as like the whole reason the Tethered exists is because of a government experiment trying to control people who live topside, but they abandoned it and put no security on any of the doors for some reason. I'm really stuck on that part, but okay. it's like he started to go somewhere with it, but it's like he didn't quite like tie it all up together into a package that fully made sense.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's one of those, the second that you start explaining the how, is the second that you'd better have an airtight explanation, and they don't really for this one.
Yeah.
And yeah, is it getting a little too far into the weeds? Sure.
100%.
But it wouldn't have been an issue if they never explained it at all. If they just left a lot of the backstory fill in a mystery, you still would have had a super creepy, really compelling commentary style film.
If they would have just left like the 1986 scenes out where you see the Tethered down there, that probably would have fixed much of the problems right there.
Totally.
Because then you wouldn't have known like, oh, they're riding a roller coaster, so the Tether have to pretend they're on the roller coaster. Like, it gets crazy down there.
Yeah, because, I mean, you've got definitely, like, well, how'd they all get in the same place? Because they don't have as much freedom to move around as you do in the above-ground world. How do they get stuck doing the actions of the people above ground when they're meant to be the ones controlling the actions of the ones above ground? When the people above ground on their own fall in love, start relationships, and have kids, then how do the ones below get automatically matched up to each other and have the same kid? Like, a different like, how do you control the genetics of it? Like, there's just a lot that is, it's unnecessary to the main thrust of the story, but the fact that they creak that door open a little bit and start explaining it to you, it just really falls apart.
Yeah, they should have left that shut.
They should have left it shut.
Well, rounding out this review, were there any other standout points of the film? Anything else you want to highlight, or any other issues that you guys may have? One of the things I wanted to highlight just real quick before we close out was the fact that Tim Heidecker played a somewhat of a serious role. Now, if you're not familiar with Tim Heidecker has a long history of doing a show on Cartoon, or actually Adult Swim, called The Tim and Eric Show, which was weird and kooky, it so and it was dumb. Just super, so super just dumb. But either way, the fact that he wasn't what I'm used to seeing him as, it was kind of like one of those instances, not as good, definitely not as good, but it was kind of like one of those instances with Dave Chappelle, seeing him in A Star Is Born, how the character he was playing was so counter what he normally plays in most films. This, seeing him actually not be weird or ridiculous or whatever, like aside from when they portray him as the other, which fit actually him more than his normal character, I have to say it was interesting seeing him flex his acting muscles outside of just being a goofball, honestly. And not that
I'm not familiar with the guy. I mean, I know who he played in the movie, but
yeah,
I've never seen him before.
It's just, it was one of those moments. It's not like an Oscar performance or anything, but it was
good. No, I was like, he was also the least interesting character, but that was by intent, I'm sure.
No, no doubt. I think it's interesting to see characters or performers, sorry, performers who begin to go counter their typecast and kind of see if they can begin treading those waters in other areas other than what they've been doing for some time, which is kind of synonymous with Jordan Peele doing horror suspense type films.
One other thing that stood out to me, and this stood out very clearly, because there's the like age old, like tongue in cheek, it's really not appropriate or funny, but it's a thing. And so we talk about it.
Yeah.
We as a culture, also we as a podcast from time to time, but the whole thing with like in an action movie or a horror movie or any kind of movie, if you have a minority character, they're the first one to die, or like all of the minority characters die. And typically your Caucasian characters are the ones more likely to survive by the end. And one of the things that happens in this movie,
yeah,
that actually is, I mean, even as a white person, it's satisfying. Like all the dead people are white people. All of
yeah.
them.
See,
every single one of them is a white person.
I don't know how I feel about
this
statement.
In this movie.
Okay. Yeah, no, like, that was something I noticed, too, and I'm like, is this supposed to be a statement of, like in horror movies, white people are quick to kill? Like, because I don't know, I don't want to touch that, but I don't know what the subtext to that statement is.
I mean, hey, you know, when you got a movie where you got to make a point, like, and the stereotypical way these horror films go, yeah, we're going to reverse that.
Absolutely. I mean, it really, to a person who grew up seeing people like him well represented in film, TV, whatever, it really makes you pause and makes you think. Like, wait a minute, all the people that look like me are the ones that are dead. Now, granted, they're also all alive because it was their opposite that killed them.
Yeah.
So that's not exactly a one-to-one comparison to typical like movie happenings. But I'm like, zombie me killed normal me. I don't know what to do with that. You know, but it does. It makes you really, as a white person,
mm-hmm.
it makes me confront the absurdity of what has been, I guess you could say, customary, like
the norm.
It tends to be the case that the white people survive, and yeah, sometimes people who aren't white also survive, but it's not
very often.
But most of the time, the non-white characters are the first ones killed off, the ones killed off the most, etc. And it's absurd.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And once you have it pointed out to you, you're like, oh wow, that is absurd. But it is a different animal to actually see it for the first time. Like, wait a minute. No, like, literally, all the white people are dead. Like, have been killed by their other.
Yeah.
And
from the beginning of any type of chaos and death that happens in this film, it is white people who are
yeah,
dying
like,
first.
And it really, it helped to reinforce the absurdity of what we've come to see as normal.
Yeah.
Like, and not just because you can laugh about it later, like, oh yeah, this is what always happens and what, but like, it truly is absurd. Like, we need to stop doing that as creative individuals telling stories that are meant to represent or include like all of humanity and not just a portion of humanity.
Yeah.
We have to stop our movies outside of this one that's making a statement, but yeah. like our normal horror movies or our normal action movies or our normal, you know, whatever, we have to stop doing that there.
Yeah.
Because it's completely absurd and has been forever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But then now, as a member of the quote-unquote majority, seeing it happen in this movie, it really underscores how absurd it is. Not that I didn't get it before, or that I didn't feel it was absurd before, but it's like, but when you see it, it just, it registers differently.
Yeah.
You know? It really reminds me, one of my favorite moments on this podcast was talking about Black Panther,
mm-hmm.
the movie, and Spencer, when you got, you know, serious about talking about seeing someone representative of your background, your life experience, you know, your physical appearance being like the hero, like no question, like nobody's questioning whether T'Challa is the hero of the story, whether he's worthy of being the hero or yeah. being the king of Wakanda or anything. Like you don't, it's yeah, duh, you know, and that was a really special moment for me because I mean, I've seen the Iron Mans and the Captain Americas and the whatever Ant-Man,
and
you
the
know,
Thors.
They're all white guys. Like I've never had a lack
yeah.
of seeing somebody somewhat like me in some respect. I wish I had Chris Hemsworth's, you know, guns, but I don't. I wish I had his hair too. He's got a good,
long blonde and flowing.
But like I've never had to
mm-hmm.
feel underrepresented in entertainment products
yeah.
or whatever. Like there's always been plenty of representation. There's too much representation to the point that I'm like, no, I don't want to be like that guy. I don't want to be like that guy. I don't want to be like that. You know, there's so much to choose from.
Yeah.
That I can literally pick and choose who I want to be like or whatever. When I was a kid, I would be that way. But it's certainly, I think, a healthy accomplishment to put the shoe on the other foot.
Yeah.
And say, okay, let this sink in. It was, I think, more on the nose with Get Out in terms of that layer of the story. Here it's more of like an unspoken subtext. There it was like in your face. But I think it's really healthy to have, like to literally see that, you know, yeah. as a member of the majority in entertainment representation or whatever, it's really healthy to see it.
Yeah.
And to say like, wait a minute, that's not fair. Duh.
Yeah.
It's never been fair.
Nope. What about you, Spence? Anything that stands out for you? Anything you want to highlight from the film as your final last words before your doppelganger comes in and takes your place?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with no.
Really?
No, I think I've covered most of the stuff. Most of my stuff is just more questions about how tethering works, and no one has an answer here.
It's true. Unless Jordan Peele is listening to this podcast, we want to know, how does the tethering really work?
Okay, but I will ask you guys a question instead.
Sure.
See if maybe you guys have an idea of what is going on in this one scene. So near the end of the movie, right before Jason is abducted,
uh-huh.
his doppelganger Pluto stops their car and gives Jason a look, and Jason knows that it's a trap from that.
I think it's so going back to what we were mentioning earlier in terms of essentially two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
I think it was Jason seeing when he is mischievous what that face looks like.
Right.
And when that face is given, he's like, oh, I know that look.
Okay. But then right after that, he could have blown up the family, but he didn't. And then like the tethering happened, ?
Mm-hmm.
And Jason made him walk into fire. Is that what happened in that scene?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jason saved his family.
Exactly.
Okay. I just wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if he could just turn it on like that. And then just questions about tethering.
I think one of the things I think that actually does point to something, maybe it was intentional, maybe not, but the kids the children in the movie seem to get it much quicker than the parents do. Like, in terms of, oh, this is a different me. This is an evil me, and I have to deal with it.
Yeah.
There's less resistance
yeah.
to the reality once they're confronted with the reality. Like, yeah, are they all shell-shocked when they see themselves in creepier versions, all in red jumpsuits? Absolutely. Any of us would be. But because they're kids, they've had less... They have probably more imagination, less time to build up a resistance to, like, this isn't what I was expecting to see, like an adult would. They really get it faster. Like, Jason in particular figures out how to get his other one trapped. Like, he's like, oh, this works for me, so it's going to work for him.
Yeah.
And so he really, like, he really gets it faster. He's not necessarily experienced enough or in a position to, like, fully deal with him until later on in the story.
Yeah.
But he gets it fast. Like, he understands, oh, you and I mirror each other somehow.
Yeah.
So I can trap you. And then later on, I can make you do something to get rid of you.
Yeah. And I think that speaks towards, like, just the understanding of, like, the innocence of children and even the games that we play as kids, you know, where we play, you know, Simon Says, or we play those types of games, you know, copycat, whatever it may be, and recognizing how through our innocence we can see when something is normal and not normal, you know, or seeing what is true and untrue or good versus evil kind of thing.
Also, I did have one last question.
Oh, yeah, no, go ahead.
And this is a rhetorical question. Nobody has to answer it.
Spence, you have to
answer. How did they get so many fancy gold scissors?
Well, you see, they're not...
when a mommy scissor and a daddy scissor really love each other.
There you go.
Yeah, thank you.
Those were nice scissors, though.
They were very nice looking scissors.
I wouldn't have any, though. Like, not after this movie.
I don't know. I'm on the market to
look
around.
But, like, where did the jumpsuits come from? Where did the scissors come from? Yeah. Like... Do they actually have some sort of a functioning society down there? I don't know. Again, it leads back into the cavern of questions that the door should never have been opened to.
Yeah. Well, and that even offers to the...
Who's taking care of those rabbits?
Well, and see, that leads to actually the rumor that this is actually still part of the Get Out universe and that this underground dwelling space or whatever is one facet of a larger story that Jordan Peele is going to create as some type of cinematic trilogy for his films. I don't know how the tie-in works, but there's some facet that this story is not done. And the film leaves on a pretty ambiguous ending, obviously. As the film closes out, we're not going to tell you everything in literally last seconds. But the film doesn't really leave you with any indication as to whether or not they're going to survive, they're going to live. They just drive off into the sunset, kind of very Western-like, and in hopes to continue to make it in this new and doppelganger world. So rounding out the review, let's go ahead and go around the table and talk about whether or not the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's go ahead and start with Sir Chad.
Sure, I'd say the film definitely passes for me. Number of monocles. This is a difficult one because I definitely like the I don't know, the teacher in me wants to reward good work in a way, which is very like highfalutin of me to say because I've never made a movie and, you know, et cetera. But at the same time, I had some serious reservations about the movie. I thought that it was, there were a lot of parts, especially in the beginning, that were refreshingly comedic when I expected the whole thing to be very tense the whole time.
Yeah.
He did a great job pacing things out so that you have funny moments to like let yourself breathe in between. And so high marks to that. I think that the performances were all really compelling. But at the same time, I really had a problem with the tethered bit. Like, I just really wasn't satisfied. I'm like, oh, okay. It would have been better not having any of it explained.
Yeah.
Like, they just appeared out of nowhere, and you deal with them or you don't. Either you win or they do. and still let the movie end on an ambiguous note, that's fine.
Yeah.
Or have that final twist. I think I'm going to give it a 3.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to give it a 3.
Well, there you go. The film passes for me. It definitely exceeds what I expected in terms of it being just a complete film. It has a solid storyline. Despite its plot holes, it still has a good storyline. It executes it from beginning to end. So the film passes for me. In terms of Monocles, I think I'm going to give it 3.5. Now, with that said, it's an exceptional story. It's a very unique story, but the problem is it does get into the weeds a bit in terms of trying to figure out how certain mechanics work, how certain parts of the story get translated, what happens to the overall world itself. Is there a promise to a future film that will give more explanation to kind of give more on the, sheds more light onto this film? I think for somebody like Jordan Peele, he should expect that his audience after Get Out is going to come in and overanalyze every single frame of this film. Mm-hmm. Doing something like what he did with the idea of tethering and even the whole underground subdwelling part of the story, he should have expected that a lot of people were going to start asking questions and wondering why certain answers that are kind of detrimental to the fullness of the story are not answered. Which leaving ambiguous would probably have served it better than giving the explanation as it did. So with that said, I'm going to give it a 3.5. I enjoyed it still, but I also want to see how this film is going to tie into something bigger, because I honestly, and I've done this already before, if this film actually leads to something else, like a third film that ties all the last two films together really well, I'd actually change my score in this one. But here's to hoping, though, that the next film, because I would be where Chad is at. I would give it a 3 just based on this film alone. But because there's the prospect of whatever may happen within this franchise, there's rumors. If this was just like by itself, like, oh, this is just a film, but, and Get Out is something separate. The rumor.
Okay, wait. You're giving this film an extra 0.5 based on rumors?
Based on the possibility of where the trajectory of the story may go.
Okay, so yes.
You know what? Listen, Doppelganger Spence. Listen, Vlad. So I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 5, Monocles. And so what about you, Spence?
Okay, this movie passes for me. I'm going to give this movie a 4. I realize I have
bias?
Way too many questions about how the whole tethering process works. But thinking through it this last week, during the movie, I was just super invested and on the edge of my seat the entire time. Mm-hmm. And, even though the last 5 minutes of the movie adds just way too many questions that I should really be thinking about, once you're in the movie, the suspense factor is pretty on point. And like you guys said, it had some fantastic acting, mm-hmm. and it was really well done in my books. So yeah. I'm going to go with a 4.
There you go. Well, that about wraps up another episode of The Filmosophers. Remember, you can let us know what your thoughts are in this episode by dropping us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmosophers or on Twitter at twitter.com/filmosophy101. Let us know what you thought. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you think Spence's doppelganger needs to replace him on the podcast? We want to hear from you. And in terms of a couple upcoming weekend releases, we have a limited release of Beach Bum, which stars Matthew McConaughey, Zac Efron, whole slew of cast characters and whatnot. So if you're in the area of one of those releases, check it out. As well, the much anticipated Disney Tim Burton film Dumbo. So get ready for nightmares galore, because when that movie comes out, I'm really interested in seeing that drunk elephant scene.
No, that's exactly why I have no interest in this movie. That scene bothered me as a child.
So this was a great conversation, and I may just need to see the film again. I don't know. I'd be willing to check it out. I don't know. But that's that. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.